You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We're now presenting the show, Jesus, the Promised Messiah, Judaism, with Roy Shulman.
Hi, this is Roy Shulman, and welcome once again to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the fulfillment, the full realization of all of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and the sacraments. Now, today's show is going to be a little bit different than typical shows, although it might be a little bit more similar with last week's show. I usually like to talk about very spiritual topics, and today I'm going to talk about something that I think is a far more spiritual topic than the way it's usually observed or understood, and that's very, very high in the news this week, which is the situation between Israel and the Palestinians with respect to the new peace plan that came from Trump. He announced it as the deal of the century, and its response, its reception by the Palestinians, and what is going on with that, and the spiritual warfare behind it, actually the spiritual underpinnings of the entire conflict in the Middle East. If any of you have read my book, Salvation is from the Jews, you'll know that the center of my intellectual interest is in the spiritual forces that underlie world history. Salvation is from the Jews is, the book itself is centered around the role of Judaism in salvation history, and a lot of it revolves around the mystery of anti-Semitism, the mystery of the persecution of the Jews leading up to the Holocaust, and after that, actually, the rise of militant Islam, let us say for the moment, and how everything you see in all of those surface phenomena are actually spiritual waves breaking through the surface. Because, in fact, the entire story of man on earth is the entire story of human history is the story of the battle between essentially Christ and the Antichrist for human souls. And nowhere is that battle more focused and pronounced than in the Holy Land, which actually, if you stop to think about it, is the one place in the world where the God-man, God when he became man, walked the earth. It's where he was born, where he lived, and where he died. And those very spots where he was born and where he lived and where he died are still venerated by Christians from around the world and are still huge hotspots of prayer. One could make a pretty cogent argument that, in fact, Israel, and in particular Jerusalem, is the holiest place on the face of the earth. In Jewish tradition, it is referred to as the navel of the world, the center, the spiritual center of all of the spiritual forces of the world. And it is in that light that I would like to talk a little bit about what's going on there now and what happened with the Trump peace plan. So if you were hoping you tune in for an entirely spiritual show, I'm afraid I will have disappointed you, at least in that sense of spiritual. But anyway, so let's continue. The Trump peace plan is extremely imaginative, sophisticated, well-developed, and it succeeds in doing what, in principle, both parties should be really interested in having out of the situation in the Middle East. It does a reasonably good job of ensuring Israel's military security in the face of the ongoing hostility from the Arab world. And it does a pretty good job of giving the Palestinians what they have claimed they have wanted for these last 30 or 40 years, which is a national homeland under their own sovereignty. What it does is it essentially divides the current state of Israel into two countries, one for the Palestinians and one for the Israelis. I won't even say Jews, because not all Israelis are Jews. There are plenty of Muslim Arabs who are Israelis also, as well as Christians and so forth. Most of the territory that's now considered the occupied territories, the Palestinian areas of Israel, are given to the Palestinian state. There's a very, very minor amount of land swapping in order to make the Palestinian state contiguous and the Jewish state, or excuse me, the Israeli state contiguous. But in fact, the terms are very favorable to the Palestinians. 90, according to the plan, 97% of today's Palestinians will be living within contiguous Palestinian territory in the new Palestinian state. That only leaves 3% who will be kind of stranded in Israel. Those 3% will not be forced to move at all. They will be given the choice. They won't be forced to move, but they will become citizens of the new state of Palestine, the territory that is going to be would be allocated to the Palestinians for their state. Would be this comparable in size to the territory of the pre-1967 Jordanian-controlled West Bank and Egypt-controlled Gaza. In other words, they'll get virtually the same amount of land that they're claiming, with a very, very minor bit of adjustment, and with all 97% of the Palestinians in that new Palestinian state. They should really, in principle, be happy with that. Israel is excited at the prospect of anything that might put an end to this continual state of assault and war for the last, I have to do some quick arithmetic, for the last 80 years, 1948, yeah, for the last 82 years, I think, if my arithmetic is correct. But when the Trump announced this plan, when the US announced this plan, the response was overwhelming and was totally consistent coming from the Palestinian side. Let me read some headlines. Headline: Palestinians demonstrate against Trump peace plan. Muslims in Gaza fire rockets into Israel. I'm reading this from today's headlines. Abbas, that's the head of the Palestinian Authority, enraged over Trump peace plan, suspends relations with the US and Israel. Another headline: Hamas top dog writes to all Islamic heads of state, urging them to reject the Trump peace plan. And on and on and on and on. I can give you a quote from the legislative body of the PLO, that's the Palestinian Authority, essentially. This is a direct quote from the official Palestinian Authority daily from January 27th, which means, what, about 3 days ago. The Palestinian National Council again expressed its objection to every plan, project, deal, or attempt to harm the Palestinian people's inalienable rights. The National Council yesterday demanded that the PLO Executive Committee implement all of the PLO Central Council's decisions, and foremost among them, the decision determining that, quote, "The transition period has ended with all of the political, security, and financial obligations in it towards the Israeli occupation, and also to take all the necessary steps to encourage and escalate the resistance and the struggle against the occupation in all its forms and manners." Now, the Arabic word for struggle is jihad. So the response of the PLO to the peace plan was a determination to encourage and escalate the jihad against Israel. Jihad, of course, being essentially holy war. Again, from the official Palestinian Authority daily: "The Palestinian National and Islamic Forces of the Ramallah and El Bira district have declared the date of the announcement of the, quote, deal of disgrace as a day of mass rage in response to the American-Israeli aggression." The deal of disgrace being the deal of the century proposed by Trump. Again, from the PA, that's Palestinian Authority daily: "The PA presidency has also announced that, quote, there is no discussion with the American administration, neither brief nor long, and that its position is unwavering on everything regarding the unacceptable deal of the century." In fact, Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, refused the call from President Trump when he, to announce the deal, to talk to him about the deal. So why this hostility to an offer which gives the Palestinians, you know, 99% of what they ever asked for in principle. And the answer to that is that this war, this battle, it's really been a kind of ongoing simmering war since the end of the Ottoman Empire, depending on how you look at it, is it's not geopolitical in nature at all. It is spiritual in nature. And to understand that, let's step back and ask two questions first. One is, what is Israel? One could say, what is Israel and the Jews? And the other question is, what is Palestine and the Palestinians? So let's go there now for now. What is Israel and what are the Jews? Well, lots of ways to look at it. You could say the Jews are the people who brought about Satan's final defeat with the coming of Christ, with the coming of the Jewish Messiah, right? In other words, we know that with the life and death of Christ on the cross, Satan was ultimately defeated. That was his defeat. His defeat came through the Jews. It's only logical that he should have a very particular hatred of the Jews. We also know that the Jews are the people related by blood to Jesus and Mary. And we also know, of course, that Satan has an incredibly intense hatred of Jesus and of Mary, and he can't get to them, but he can get to their blood relatives, the Jews. The Jews are the people that God chose from, one could almost say, the beginning of time, but certainly from 2000 BC, to bring salvation to all of mankind, thus defeating the enemy, defeating Satan. And what is Israel? Israel is the one place on the face of the earth where the God-man himself was born, lived, and died. And the holy sites in Israel, where he did so, are arguably the holiest spots on earth. So we can see a lot of reasons why the enemy should have this very focused attack on Israel and on the Jews in Israel. Now, what are the Palestinians? And here I am going to get, I'm not going to say controversial, because it's not controversial in the sense that there are disputable facts, but it's controversial in the sense that these facts are fairly well suppressed and have been replaced by a veneer of false facts, a veneer of a fiction that has kind of taken over much of the world press and discussion of the underlying issues. So what is Palestine and the Palestinians? First of all, Palestine, the first part of this piece of my discussion is going to be Palestine until the 1960s, okay? Until the 1960s, the word Palestine never, ever, ever referred to a country. It never, ever, ever referred to a people, a nationality, an ethnic group, you know, a language, a culture, anything. Until the 1960s, the word Palestine, and we're talking about from the 2nd century AD until the 1960s, the word Palestine always referred to one thing, and that is a geographic region, geography. It never referred to a people. In fact, as late as the 1930s and 1940s, the word Palestinian, when it appeared in the press, when it appeared in government documents, referred to an inhabitant of Palestine, whether they were Jewish, whether they were Muslim, whether they were Christian, whether they were Druze or whatever. It simply referred to an inhabitant of that geographic region. The name Palestine itself was given to the region by the Romans upon their destruction of Judea and Israel, upon their destruction of the Jewish nation and the exile of the Jews, in order to humiliate the Jews and to erase the Jewish history of the area. They gave that territory the name Palestine, naming it after the Philistines in the Old Testament, because the Philistines were the number one enemy of the Jews. So it was a made-up name to name that territory in a way that would insult the Jews and kind of eradicate the history of it as being the Jewish homeland. For that entire period between the Roman Empire in the 2nd century AD and World War I in the 20th century, that territory was referred to as Palestine, or more often Syria-Palestina, because it was considered the southern province of Syria, the southern part of Syria. So it was called Syria-Palestinia from the 2nd century AD until the beginning of the 20th century AD. What happened then? Well, let me back up a little bit. From the 14th century AD until World War I, that entire region, all of the Middle East essentially, was part of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was a Muslim empire. It was centered in Istanbul, and it was a Muslim empire. It was actually the world center of the world of Islam. It was one country. It was under one caliph or ruler. There were no national boundaries within it. It was ruled as all of the world should be under Islam, which is it all should be one people under one theocratic ruler, the caliph, whose job is to impose Sharia law, to impose Islamic law on everybody, and thereby make the entire world submit to Islam. Of course, that's the meaning of the word Islam, is submission, because Allah wants everyone in the world to submit to him. So it was part of the Ottoman Empire from the 14th century until World War I. And then in World War I, the Turks sided with the Germans and lost. And the Ottoman Empire was disbanded, was dissolved, and the territory was put under the control of the French and the British. So from that moment on, we're talking about 1918, what had been Syria-Palestina became known as the British Mandate of Palestine. In other words, it was the same territory, the southern section of Syria, that was no longer a piece of the Ottoman Empire. It was a geographic region under control of the British, and the population was composed of Arabs and Jews and Christians, and very roughly speaking, with about a two-thirds, if I remember correctly, around two-thirds Muslim, or two-thirds Arab Muslim, and one-third Jews. Now, the British inherited, so to speak, or they found themselves with this territory. It was composed of Jews and Arabs. The Arabs had been at war against the Jews since, this gets complicated, but since the late 19th century, they were at war against the Jews because it's an edict of Islam that anyone who lives in an Islamic area has to be submitted to Islam, either as being a Muslim or as being what's called a dhimmi, which is a kind of a serf who's there at the sufferance of the Muslims and has to, basically like a serf, he can't really own anything in his own right, or anything he owns can be taken by the Muslims. He has to pay a special tax and so forth. It was fine for the Jews to live there as long when it was the Ottoman Empire, because they had to live as dhimmis, they had to live as these serfs, so that wasn't really offensive to the Muslims, because the Muslims could take advantage of the situation. But then, in the tail end of the 19th century, under the pressure of the British and the French, the Ottoman Empire had to stop that oppression of non-Muslims. And at that point, a kind of war broke out between the Muslims and the Jews, because now the Jews were a thorn in their side, because they were supposed to be submitted to Islam but weren't. Okay, so there was this tension there. There was this conflict there. When it came under the control of the British in 1919, the British decided to divide it up, a two-state solution. This was the first two-state solution. You've heard that expression, right? Two-state solution for peace in the Middle East. It was the first two-state solution, and the British gave, roughly speaking, 80% of that territory to the Arabs and 20% to the Jews, the dividing line being the Jordan River, the territory to the west of the Jordan River being given to the Jews, and the territory to the east of the Jordan River comprising about 80%. I've seen different numbers from 77% to 83%, depending on how you measure things, being given to the Arabs, the first two-state solution. That was completely unacceptable to the Arab side, because it still left a sovereign Jewish entity, or rather a Jewish entity which wasn't under the rule of Sharia, that wasn't under the rule of Islam, where it had once been under the rule of Islam. Now, I have to back up a little bit and say, why is that offensive? Why is that intolerable? It's intolerable because the Quran itself totally forbids any territory that had ever been under the control of Islam to ever not be under the control of Islam. The world, and I have to, I'm looking through my notes because I'm going out of order, and I want to find the quote from the Quran. But since, if I can't find it, oh, here it is. There is a verse in the Quran, this is chapter 2, verses 190 to 194, which says, quote, "Kill them whenever you confront them and drive them out from where they drove you out." In other words, if there's any territory that the Muslims had control over, that they no longer have control over, it is a command from Allah, from God, in the Quran, that you have to drive them out. And this is because the Great Commission in Islam, you know, the Great Commission in Christianity is go forth and make disciples of all nations. The Great Commission in Islam is basically go forth and subdue the entire world, make the entire world submit to Islam. By conversion, if it works, and if not by conversion, by the sword. The world in Islam is divided into what's called Dar al-Islam, which is the land of Islam, and Dar al-Harb, which is the land of war. In other words, they're not supposed to be individual countries. They're supposed to be this growing territory, which is the world of Islam, and it's to spread and spread and spread until it takes over the entire world. And wherever it meets its boundaries and hasn't yet taken over the next piece of territory, that becomes the land of war, the Dar al-Harb, which is has to be submitted to war until it's conquered. So that's the world in Islam, and to have this Jewish entity, not only on land which had been Muslim, but in the heart of Dar al-Islam, in the heart of the Islamic world, was complete anathema and intolerable. Now, why would it be completely intolerable? See, this really is spiritual. It sounds like I'm talking about politics, but I hope I'm not. I really think it's all spiritual. The reason it's intolerable, we have to go back to the life of Muhammad and the foundation of Islam and the Quran, okay? One of the ways that Jesus convinced people that he was who he, I don't want to say said he was, but one of the ways that Jesus showed people who he was by the many miracles that he performed, right? He showed his apostles, he stilled the waves, he had the miraculous catch of 153 fish, he healed countless of his followers, right? People came from all over that part of the world to be healed at the touch or at the word of Jesus. The miracles that Jesus performed were uncountable. You could ask a Muslim, what miracle did Muhammad perform to give proof of the claims of Islam? And there's one answer. There are two miracles. One answer is the Quran itself. The Quran itself is such a wonderful work. It's clearly miraculous. The other miracle, victory in war. Victory in war was the miracle that Muhammad repeatedly pointed to show that he was working for God, to show that God is on our side. The proof that Muhammad was speaking for God and that Allah is the true God and Islam is the true religion is that God would ensure that the Muslims were militarily victorious over all their foes. You probably have read in the newspaper when there is an act of violence in the name of Islam, you know, when there's a jihadi attack, when the people shot up the Jewish delicatessen in New Jersey or when they knifed a couple of British soldiers on the streets of London, they shout Allahu Akbar. Now, the newspapers often translate Allahu Akbar as God is great, but that's not a correct translation. The translation of Allahu Akbar is God is greater. And the fact that they're able to slit the throat of these Christians or machine gun these Jews going about their business is proof that Allah is the true God and therefore more powerful than the God of the Christians or the God of the Jews. So you see that this teaching, this principle, that military victory is the fundamental proof of the truth of Islam, means that when you have Israel in the middle of the Muslim world being militarily victorious over the rest of the Muslim world, it's actually a theological crisis. It produces a crisis of faith. It is an existential threat to the claims of Islam, because the whole premise of Islam is that the proof that Islam is true is that the enemy will not be victorious over it. So here you have this tiny state of Israel being victorious over the rest of the Arab world, the Muslim world. You can see the theological crisis it produces. So that is why the first two-state solution proposed in 1919 by the British, the next two-state solution, which was proposed by the British in 1936, I believe, in the Peel, by the Peel Commission, the two-state solution proposed by the UN, or not proposed, but enacted by the UN in 1948, when they actually formally established the State of Israel, was not successful. But the very next day, all of the Arab Muslim countries launched a war against Israel because the sovereign state there could not be permitted to exist because of the command in the Quran. And worse, they were defeated and Israel was victorious, which then becomes this huge theological threat to the claims of Islam. And it, of course, got worse every time there was a war and Israel was victorious. It was victorious in the Suez Campaign in 1956. It was victorious in the Six-Day War in 1967. It was victorious in the Yom Kippur War in 1973. Come hell or high water, Israel must be destroyed as a sovereign state. I'm not even going to say as a Jewish state, because unless it is under control of the Muslims, unless it's submitted to Islam, it is a theological crisis for Islam. It has to be conquered. Now that is, okay, so now let's get back to the Palestinians. So there, as I said, there really were no Palestinian people. There wasn't a concept of a Palestinian people until the 1960s. What there were these Arab Muslims who were not only indistinguishable ethnically, linguistically, culturally, or even by family ties with the Arab Muslims in the rest of that, essentially the Ottoman Empire, Egypt and Syria and Lebanon and Jordan. Most of them actually came from other places in that territory. And until the 1960s, they never even wanted to be thought of anything different. And I will read some quotes from Arab Muslims, essentially Palestinians, from the days of the British Mandate until the 1960s, that gives evidence to the fact that they did not consider themselves anything different. So here we go with a series of quotes. 1937, Abdul Hadi, Arab Muslim leader, to the Peel Commission. That was a British commission to determine what to be done with this region. There is no such country as Palestine. There is no Palestine in the Bible. Our country was for centuries part of Syria. 1946, Arab historian Hitti at the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry, quote, there is no such thing as Palestine in history. Absolutely not. 1974, the representative of the Arab Higher Committee at the UN. That's interesting. That's 1974, so it's after the 60s. Palestine was part of the province of Syria. Politically, the Arabs of Palestine were not independent. I jumped out of the timeline there. So back to 1948, King Abdullah of Transjordan, the country we now call Jordan, at the time was called Transjordan. It was on one side of the Jordan River. King Abdullah of Transjordan, quote, Palestine and Transjordan are one. In the 1960s, the Syrian president Hafez Assad to Arafat, quote, to Yasser Arafat, who, claimed to represent the Palestinian people, quote, You do not represent Palestine. There is no such thing as a Palestinian people. There is no Palestinian entity. There is only Syria. You are an integral part of the Syrian people. Palestine is an integral part of Syria. 1970, Prince Hassan of the Jordanian National Assembly, quote, Palestine is Jordan, and Jordan is Palestine. There's only one land with one history and one and the same fate. Interestingly, we'll go forward to 1977. So this is after the fiction of Palestine and the Palestinian people had started to get traction. However, a member of the PLO Security Committee named Zahir Mousain gave an interview in a Dutch newspaper, and he said the following, quote, the Palestinian people do not exist. The creation of a Palestinian state is only a means for continuing our struggle against the State of Israel for our Arab unity. In reality today, there is no difference between Jordanians, Palestinians, Syrians, and Lebanese. Only for political and tactical reasons do we speak today about the existence of a Palestinian people, since Arab national interests demand that we posit the existence of a distinct Palestinian people to oppose Zionism. For tactical reasons, Jordan, which is a sovereign state with defined borders, cannot raise claims to Haifa and Jaffa, while as a Palestinian, in quotes, I can demand Haifa, Jaffa, Beersheba, and Jerusalem. However, the moment we reclaim our right to all of Palestine, we will not wait even a minute to unite Palestine and Jordan. End of quote. So those are all quotes by Palestinian authorities, by Palestinian representatives, by Palestinian historians, asserting aggressively that basically there is no such thing as Palestine. There was a region of Syria. There's no distinct people who are Palestinians. So where did the concept of Palestinians come from? In fact, it was invented in the 1960s. I think it's a little bit debatable whether it was invented after the Six-Day War. I'd like to say it was invented after the Six-Day War, but it certainly wasn't invented before the 1960s. Now I will read a quote from Robert Spencer, who was a Catholic deacon and a lifelong Islam scholar. It's a little bit of a long quote, but it's actually a documented history, and it tells you where the concept came from. And then after I read this quote, I think I will relax a little bit and get a little more spiritual in my discussion. But here is the origin of the concept of the Palestinian people. Quote, this is all a quote from Robert Spencer. In order to destroy the impression of the tiny Jewish state facing enormous Muslim Arab foes and prevailing, the Soviet KGB developed the fiction of an even smaller people, the Palestinians, menaced by a well-oiled and ruthless Israeli war machine. Never had the name Palestinian referred to anything but a region, not to a people or an ethnicity. In the 1960s, however, the KGB and Haji Amin al-Husseini's nephew Yasser Arafat created both these allegedly oppressed people and the instrument of their freedom, the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO. Ion Mihai Pacheba, I'm going to interject a little bit. He was the chief of Communist Romania's spy service. He actually defected to the West, and he published his memoirs with very interesting inside information on what the KGB was doing during the Cold War, because Romania was actually the country where the KGB would meet with leaders from the West in order to be under the radar of any observation, in order to meet secretly. And he was the head of Romania's secret police, so he always had the meeting places bugged and spied on when the KGB was meeting with their Western puppets or dupes or whatever you want to call them. I strongly recommend his book. I think it's called Red Horizons. It's got amazing inside stuff in it. Anyway, back to the quote. Ion Pacheba, the chief of Communist Romania's spy service, wrote, quote, the PLO was dreamt up by the KGB, which had a penchant for liberation organizations. There was the National Liberation Army of Bolivia, created by the KGB in 1964 with help from Che Guevara. The KGB also created the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which carried out numerous bombing attacks. In 1964, the first PLO Council, consisting of 422 Palestinian representatives hand-picked by the KGB, approved the Palestinian National Charter, a document that had been drafted in Moscow. The Palestinian National Covenant and the Palestinian Constitution were also born in Moscow with the help of Ahmed Shukeri, a KGB influence agent, who also became the first PLO chairman. For Arafat to head up, that was all a quote directly from Ion Pachipa. For Arafat to head up the PLO, he had to be a Palestinian. Pachipa explained in his book that, quote, Arafat was an Egyptian bourgeois turned into a devoted Marxist by the KGB. The KGB had trained him at its Balashika Special Operations School east of Moscow, and in the mid-1960s decided to groom him as the future PLO leader. First, the KGB destroyed the official records of Arafat's birth in Cairo and replaced them with fictitious documents saying that he had been born in Jerusalem and was therefore a Palestinian by birth. I'm going to interject something. They may have produced false birth documents, but they did not erase his life history. So, in fact, the fact that he grew up in Cairo is uncontested. So, okay, take a deep breath, Roy. First of all, let me say this, in principle, is a live call-in show. So let me, at this point, having gone through the kind of hardcore part of my discussion, I will invite calls and callers. The number here is 866-333-6279 or 866-333-MARY, M-A-R-Y. And if I see a call appear on the message board here, I will interrupt myself to take the call for your question or comment or whatever. Back to this kind of one-sided discussion. One-sided because I'm the only one speaking, not one-sided because it doesn't fairly represent both views. But anyway, so if there was never a Palestine or a Palestinian people, what's going on? And of course the answer is the true conflict is between Christ and the Antichrist. I talked about the theological proof of the truth of Islam being the military victory of Islam over its enemies. There is no enemy of Islam as great as the Jews as an enemy. Who are the Jews? And I will read citations from the Quran. By the way, let me interrupt myself and say I have been heavily dependent in this discussion on a recent book by Robert Spencer called The Palestinian Delusion. And if you want a really good background to all of this stuff, I strongly recommend that book. It's, of course, widely available, and it's on Amazon. It's called The Palestinian Delusion by Robert Spencer, S-P-E-N-C-E-R. So anyway, quotes from the Quran who tell Muslims who the Jews are. They are the strongest of all people in enmity towards the Muslims, chapter 4, verse 82. They fabricate things and falsely ascribe them to Allah, chapter 2, verse 79. They claim that Allah's power is limited, 564. They love to listen to lies, 541. They disobey Allah and never observe his commands, 513. They are disputing and quarreling, 247. They hide the truth and mislead people, 378. They stage rebellion against the prophets and reject their guidance, 255. Are hypocritical, 214. Give preference to their own interests over the teachings of Muhammad, 287. Wish evil for people and try to mislead them, 2109. Feel pain when others are happy or fortunate, 3120. Are arrogant about their being Allah's beloved people, 518. That one, I'll confess, is probably true. Devour people's wealth by subterfuge, 4161. Slander the true religion and are cursed by Allah, 446. Are merciless and heartless, 274. Never keep their promises or fulfill their words, 2100. Are unrestrained in committing sins, 579. Are cowardly, 5913. Were transformed into apes and pigs, for breaking the Sabbath, 2:63, and several others. They are under Allah's curse, 9:30, and Muslims should wage war against them and subjugate them under Islamic rule, 9:29. On top of that, we have a quote from Muhammad in the Hadith, kill any Jew who falls under your power. We have the fact that according to Islam, Muhammad's death came about when he was poisoned by a Jewish woman who invited him to a feast and fed him poisoned food. A certain example of the Jews' treachery and also the requirement to avenge that, of course. And we have the fact that the Day of Resurrection won't happen in Islam until all the Jews are killed. These are the people now who have a sovereign nation that's defeating Islam in the heart of Dar al-Islam. You can certainly see the theological impetus behind what's going on in the necessity, existential necessity, of the Muslim world to eradicate the Jewish state of Israel. Now, I guess I'd better. We have the poor Palestinian people who are suffering, no question. They're caught in the middle. What are they? They are people who lived in the. They're not people who lived in Israel when Israel became a nation. I talked about this a little bit last week, but I'll do it very quickly. In 1948, the UN established Israel as a sovereign nation, gave them all of the land west of the Jordan River. That land was composed of Jews and non-Jews, Jews and Arabs. When it was established as a Jewish state, the new Jewish state publicized, went around with trucks with loudspeakers on top, saying there's no need for you Arabs to leave. You're welcome to stay. We want you as full partners, full citizens, full participants in this wonderful new initiative that we're starting, the new state of Israel. Meanwhile, all in the entire Arab world was telling them, you have to leave Israel. Because if you stay there, you will be siding with the enemy and we will slaughter you when we enter Israel. But if you leave and come over the border to the Arab world, then in 2 weeks, when we've eradicated all the Jews, you can return to your home and share in their wealth and property and so forth. But if you don't leave now, you won't be able to do that, but rather you will be one of the enemy and you will be killed when we kill the Jews. So even though the new Israeli government was telling the Arabs who were in Israel to stay, most of them left. The ones who stayed became full Israeli citizens, no difference between them and a Jew. They're Arab Muslims in the parliament in Israel. They're Arab Muslims who run for office. They're Arab Muslims in the court system as judges and everything else. There's no discrimination whatsoever. There's no first-class, second-class citizenship. There's no apartheid. There is nothing discriminating against Arab Israelis. However, the Arabs who had been living in Israel when that 1948 war broke out and left and went over to Jordan to await the Arab victory and then come back, they were not given citizenship in Israel when Israel ended up winning the war. They had sided with the enemy. They had left. They were not permitted back into Israel. And almost worse, Jordan didn't let them into Jordan. The Arab states didn't let them into the Arab states. The Arab states left them in refugee camps. They would not let them out of the refugee camps. And in fact, they were denied citizenship, the right to live in all of the Arab states. And there was one point relatively recently, I'd say it's in the 1970s even, that I think was Qatar, had such a shortage of manpower that they announced that they would give citizenship to any Arab who would come there and work, except Palestinians, because the Arab world was united in the determination that we had to keep these people in these horrible conditions in the refugee camps. They were imprisoned there, not by Israel, because they were now in Jordan. This had nothing to do with Israel. The Palestinian refugee camps, which are this emblem, this symbol of Israeli oppression, they weren't Israeli refugee camps. They were Jordanian run camps to imprison the Palestinian refugees so that they would be there as a tool to be used to essentially conquer Israel and gain world opinion in opposition to Israel. Then we have to fast forward. So that's the situation from 48 to 67. The Palestinian refugees were being held in Palestinian refugee camps by Jordan in Jordan, or perhaps there were also some being held by Egypt in the Gaza Strip. Because what had happened was that in 1948, when the entire Arab world, which outnumbered Israel 50 to 1, launched war on tiny, vulnerable Israel, they did not win that war, and an armistice was reached after a number of weeks, and the armistice lines were drawn at, they're essentially ceasefire lines, where the two armies were meeting at the time that the peace agreement came, or the armistice agreement came. This happens all the time in wars. You know, you have a ceasefire, and then there is a line of demarcation between the opposing forces. That becomes the armistice line. So the Egypt had a successfully made incursion into the Gaza Strip, which had been given to Israel. So the armistice line gave didn't give anything to Egypt, but Egypt had control of territory to the south of the armistice line, which was Israeli territory given to Israel by the UN when it made it a state, and given by the British under the British mandate when it divided up the territory and all of those things I said. So you had the armistice line that created the Gaza Strip under Egyptian control. You had the armistice line that created the West Bank under Jordanian control. But that was Israeli territory, actually, which is occupied by hostile forces that had made those incursions during the war. That's the state of things until 1967, when the Arab world again launched an unprovoked war against Israel with the express determination to wipe it out. And this time, Israel was more victorious and actually pushed back the occupation, so that now those areas that had been given to Israel by the UN but had been occupied by either Jordan or Egypt from 1948 until 1967 were once again under Israeli control. Those are the occupied territories. I don't think they're the occupied territories. I think they're the liberated territories, because they had been occupied by hostile forces which had only gained them through a military incursion, and now they returned to by international law in principle legal custodians or owners, which was they were part of the state of Israel. They never stopped being a part of the state of Israel. When people talk about Israel annexing the West Bank or the Gaza Strip, it's a misuse of terms, because annexing means annexing land from another country. You have to answer the question, what country did that land belong to? Never belonged to any country since 1948, except Israel. Before then, it belonged to Great Britain, but Great Britain had given it to the future state of Israel. So anyway, that's the occupied territories. However, the Palestinians are the victims in this scenario, because they are comprised of the Arabs who, under the intimidation of the Arab authorities, fled Israel in the 1948 war and weren't allowed to come back. And then the Arabs who took up residence in the territory that Jordan or Egypt conquered in the 48 war, and then when Israel took it back in the 67 war, they found themselves under Israeli control as Palestinians, close quote. In other words, as these Arabs unwillingly under Israeli sovereignty, and then eventually became the PLO and this entire kind of revolutionary spearhead force in order to do what the Arab world was always determined to do, which was to eradicate this contradiction of the theological claims of Islam represented by a Jewish state in the heart of Dar al-Islam, in the heart of the world of Islam, the land of Islam. So there you have it. I hope that was coherent. I'm amazed that I did as well as I did. You'll have to tell me whether it was good enough or not. I want to thank you for listening, because if you've come to this point, you have listened. Thank you very much. All of this only makes sense spiritually. It does not make sense in any geopolitical terms. And I really got very excited at the opportunity to kind of paint a picture of what's going on in the world from the perspective of its true causality, which is everything in this world is about man's salvation. God created this world for one reason only, and that is out of his love for us, in order to bring us to be with him for all eternity in unimaginable bliss. And unfortunately, an enemy arose at the already before man was created, when Lucifer fell, who wants to get back at God by destroying the purpose of his creation, by destroying the salvation of man, by bringing as many people to perdition as possible. And therefore, the intelligent way of looking at world history is to see it as the surface manifestation of this battle between Satan and God for the salvation of human souls. So with that, let me close the show. Let me actually say a quick prayer, St. Michael prayer, for obvious reasons, in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. St. Michael, the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our defense against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray, and do thou, O Prince of the Heavenly Host, by the divine power of God, cast into hell Satan and all the evil spirits who patrol the world, seeking the ruin and destruction of souls. Amen. Amen. Thank you for listening. You've been listening to Roy Schoeman on Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria. I promise that next week we'll go back to a at least somewhat more purely sursum corda spiritual show. But thank you for bearing with me. Thank you for listening this week, and I hope you join us again next week, same time, same place, on Radio Maria for Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, with me, your host, Roy Schoeman. It's time to say bye for now.